Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love, coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, our latest interview with our guest, Xochitl Gonzalez, who is here with us today to talk about her debut novel, Olga Dies Dreaming, which I absolutely loved. It's one of my first Book Reporter Bets on Selections of 2022. And those are the books that I know that I can put in people's hands and say, I think I bet you're going to love it. So welcome, Xochitl. So nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted. And thank you for your enthusiasm about Olga.
Just love Olga. And there's so many different faces of Olga. And that's the reason I can't wait to be talking to you about her. So let's start with you telling us a little bit about Olga Dies Dreaming.
Yeah. So Olga Dies Dreaming is a family saga that takes place mainly in Brooklyn and in Puerto Rico. And it focuses on the adult children, Olga, the eponymous Olga, who is a wedding planner to New York's elite, and her brother Prieto, who is a congressman representing South Brooklyn and parts of Queens and Manhattan. And they were raised by their grandmother in Sunset Park, which he represents now. And they were raised in part that way because their parents, who had been former Young Lords activists, sort of took very different paths. Their father sort of relapsed into addiction, and their mother, after leaving the Lords, became radicalized and kind of left them to pursue social justice by any means necessary. And we encounter them when they are, Olga is 40 and her brother is about 44, and they seemingly have it all together. And then under the surface, they have swept a lot of these family secrets and their traumas around it under the rug, and they all come bubbling back when Hurricane Maria brings their mother back into their lives. So it takes place mainly in Brooklyn, or in the months before and after. There's a bit of a love story. In a lot of ways, it's a coming of age book, but it's a middle-aged coming of age book. And in that sense, it's a little bit unique.
Yeah, and that I really love, because you've got some maturity, but there is some immaturity at the same time. There's a little bit of each going on here.
Oh, completely.
You ran a successful wedding planning business for years, and it influenced so much of the beginning of the book, the early chapters in the book. And that's when I started. I was thinking this was going to be this very light book. And I thought it was like almost like a rom-com at the beginning of her setting up these weddings for these people. And you just know what these people are like. Like, you just know, like, I must have this, like, you know, bird, and the bird doesn't exist, or, you know, just whatever. And I like the first chapter is called The Napkins, and it just sets the tone of what her life is like with this. So was it fun writing about all those wedding details, because it was something you did in your real life as well?
Oh, totally. It was actually, that was in some funny ways the most fun. And like, well, I know we'll at some point talk about the adaptation, but that's been fun in the adaptation also. But like this, there are these little weird tidbits that, you know, you like, you sometimes they become disassociated. You don't even remember what was the family or who was the mother, but you're like, I just remember this thing. Like, I had somebody do my makeup for an event once, and I randomly was like, I had a bride once, and she told the makeup artist about the bridesmaids, make them all look like little piggies. And like, I don't even remember which wedding it is. I just remember that happened. So it was a lot of fun to put those weird little tidbits, but also like in that first chapter, you know, there's a thing that was a throwaway line, but it was something that really happened, where it's like, they were all very frightened by a lawsuit when somebody substituted an English rose for an Ecuadorian rose. And that had really like was a variation on something that really happened. And I think the idea of sort of this upstairs, downstairs, and the service class that makes these kind of things happen was like, I wanted to give life to that. And I think wedding planning is particularly intriguing because on the one hand, it seems like a very high-end profession and people are very much like, I used to get invited to so many cocktail parties because people are like, what a dream job, you know? Like, and on the other hand, like, you actually probably have a lot more in common with the bussers than you do with the guests. Like, so it was a cool way to sort of enable us to look at the class dynamics of New York too.
You're in both worlds. You're really in both worlds, because when you show up in the room, you have to show up like them, like one step down, like one step down. But then when you go talk to the busboy, you've got to be one step up from them. So you're sort of like got these two different personas you have to turn on at every moment of get the glasses on the table and, oh, the glasses look beautiful, like going back and forth.
Exactly, exactly. And so I think, and I thought that that felt like a really also cool parallel just for a protagonist, a Latina protagonist. And, you know, I wrote her to be a little bit more like myself, where she's, you know, very white passable. Like, I think it was a cool way to also parallel that other kind of code switching that she needs to do all the time in her personal professional educational life and that. But at the same time, showing it in a way, you know, life is often more amusing than it is tragic. Like even when it's tragic, it can be kind of amusing. So I think like the profession enabled me to also insert a bit of the comedy of life, as I like to think about it.
Yeah, my niece is getting married soon. It's like all these details, and I'm just there like, I'm trying to remember who was at my wedding. Somebody's talking about the pictures, and I said, here's what you really need to do with the pictures. Take a picture of every table, and then in 20 years, pull out and say, do you know the people at that table? You know?
Totally. But you don't know, you're not going to care at the time.
Right. You don't know. You have no idea. You have no idea. I did set up a couple that got married. They met at our wedding and got married. So I considered I was highly successful, and two other couples dated for a while. So I thought my seat dealing was very, very well done. Planning.
Yeah. Excellent. Yes.
Very good planning. So you talk about also about Olga's forays into television, including her own show in 2017 that doesn't test well across the country. And it's so funny because I bet in 2021, that show would be picked up so fast.
So fast. It's weird, isn't it? Like, you know, writing a book, I'm glad it's very specifically set in a period of time because things are changing so fast. And even honestly, I actually think like, you know, a lot of what you get in this book is like her inner thoughts about being asked to do some of these things and sort of asked to perform a more stereotyped version of her. And what's cool about the release coming now is I think there's a more of an open mind. I remember telling friends, like, I'd be like, and then they asked me to do this. I'd like, you know, let's say like a non-Latina friend, and they'd be like, really? Like almost like not believing me. And now I think we're in a space where everybody's like, I believe that happened.
Yeah, I saw that. I can understand that.
Our minds, the collective mindset has become more open to hearing some of these, like, especially these more microaggressive things that happen. Yes. Like, yeah, yeah. So it's the TV thing also was a little bit based on experiences that I had really had. And I found that, I also find like just the absurdity of pop culture right now is so intriguing. And especially like the last decade, you know, like the entire sort of thing about like performance and wedding is entertainment and life is entertainment, but it has to be heightened and it's reality.
And there's nothing reality about reality television. Nothing. My husband sat in a restaurant one time and they were taping something and they said, you're going to be on the show. Like he could care. Right. But he had a sign release and he said, they did that thing like 10 times. There was nothing real about it. One was better than the 10th. You know, it was.
Totally. I always say, I was like the best actor. They should have a reality TV Emmy for acting, and Scott would get the award every year. Like he was like the best person in the Keeping Up the Kardashians. So, but like really, like I think it was so not real, and it was so hilarious to me that it gets presented that way. And so it was kind of fun. That was also sort of a fun thing that, you know, is part of the mechanics, though. The weirdly part of the mechanics of building like a successful interior design business, a successful wedding planning, a successful catering business, like, you know, this performative aspect of things now. It's like part of the formula, I think.
It's like the way we must behave. But I do say, I read page 6 every day, and I don't know who most of the people are. And I used to know who everybody was. And now I'm like, who are these people and why do they even get an inch? Like, why are they really that important? Am I that out of it that I don't know who this person is? They got a whole inch of copy. You know, I don't know who they are, you know?
It's so weird.
I'm that out of it.
Well, and I think some of that too, don't you think, is like, it's interesting to see even with, you know, with books, but like there's so many subcultures now and some ways of being famous, you know, like, I mean, somebody told me they spotted them by like, they were like, oh, you know, they're very famous on YouTube. And I was like, and you recognize them? Like, I was like, really? Like, I know, I was really like, oh, and you're right. But I was like, oh, I just missed that age bracket. That's just not my generation. You know, like that's not
of my on TikTok.
I hear that also all the time. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like I finally had to get to a place where I'm like, I buy that. Like, I just know, I don't know. It's weird.
You have to be really careful because like I went on TikTok one time and I watched something that was one of those gender reveals, which I don't understand why I am so into like seeing whether it's a boy or a girl of people I don't even know. Okay. So then all of a sudden, every time I went on, I was getting a gender reveal and I was just there like, why am I watching and why do I care? But it's like this sub-level of entertainment that it's like right there for you, you know, there for the taking.
So funny and weird. Oh my gosh. Anyway. I know.
So Olga followed the same path as you with her business. We won't say like, you know, what happens like, you know, later on. You mentioned at one point you thought about writing this as a memoir. And was this detail one of the things that remained? And why not a memoir? What made you pull back and say novel?
You know, there's a line in the book where her grandmother says to her, the truth can be harder to believe than a fiction. And I think that I actually workshopped that same beginning of what would have been a memoir version of this, like at three different places. And finally, they were like, there's just too much happening. And it was like, and I was like, you know what? I think that this would be better served if I make this more fictional. And I honestly will say, like, that enabled me to, I don't even want to say embellish, but like have more, put more meaning into some of the story. And I think it's funny, when we were working on the adaptation, one of the actors involved was like, that was going to play Johnny, was like, I'm just nervous about playing like a stereotype. And I was like, well, I think the way that I'm thinking about it is not a stereotype. I was like, it's a real phenomena that so many people that went to Vietnam came back with drug addictions, you know, like it's real. And then they're back in their communities. And it's a real phenomenon that a lot of people got cleaned up in the Lords. And then what happens when the movement's over? And so, you know, I think really it gave me the freedom to sort of give more meaning and more depth to some of things that also, you know, the other thing is that I always think about, the other reason why I'll never write a memoir, I think, is that I was an only child raised by my grandparents. And everybody is dead and I have no witnesses and I don't trust that I remember things right. So
I know. It's like, yeah, wait a second. Wait, was my lens okay? I'm not like quite sure. You know,
But this, it enabled me to kind of tie more meaning into things. And I think, the root of it was, I was really intrigued by the fact that, like, you know, my parents had been so like gung-ho, like, you know, socialist Brown power movement. And honestly, when I got out of college, I went to Brown and they were sort of like, who cares? Like, go to Brooklyn College. You know, like they were really not like, who are you trying to impress? Like, it was really like unimpressive to them. And then when I finished, I was like, what was I interested in? I was like, I wanted to get into all the clubs. I was like, how do I get to Puffy's white party in the Hamptons? Like, I wanted to be absolutely. Oh, and it was like Sex in the City. And so I was like spending all my paychecks on Manola Blahniks. Like, it was like really, I found, looking back, that to be funny. And I always say like, Olga was me if I never had therapy. So like, you know, and I just sort of thought, it was an intriguing thing, like how one generation values none of those material things and is all about a cause. And then the next generation is literally like, so this is my new designer purse. And this is this. And why is that? Like, why are we like that? And so I felt like the fiction of it. And also that's why I wanted to give her a brother, because I think it's so interesting too, how like siblings can be, get the same information, the same data put in them, and then come out with completely different conclusions. So like, yes.
It's like totally different stuff. I will tell you that we used to park in the same parking garage where the guys from Universal Records parked.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I used to say, I think there's some rapper in the garage right now, but I don't recognize them, but you didn't want to come down. And then P. Diddy parked his cars that he took to the Hamptons. He had these three little cars that were always on the first floor. And I was just there like, this is kind of fun. It's like I'm in the celebrity garage, but I don't even like know who the celebrities are, you know?
That's so fun. No, I mean, it was like the auteur of fantastically vain time. Like, I knew a guy who literally made a fortune selling mink teddy bears that looked like R&B and pop stars. Like, they dressed like this mink teddy bears dressed like Britney Spears. Like, and it was like a legit business, you know? Right. It was a world in which you valued mink teddy bears. So I think that I found somebody that would have come of age in that and not ever had any self-awareness of it, having to kind of experience that, really interesting in some way. Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of like, oh, there, what's going on? This one guy parked in the garage and he was the senior VP, like a senior executive VP, like one of those titles you couldn't get any bigger, of physical and like digital record sales. And I was like, wow, what a job. He goes, okay, just think about this. Where are we selling records these days? What stores are still open? He goes, number one, he doesn't have this job anymore, so I can say this. And the second thing he says, besides that, he goes, we're selling songs one at a time. And he says, you have to play it 500 times on, like, you know, Spotify or something.
It's so one true. Thing.
And it was just so funny because we have this idea of what music was and what this is, and it's all changed. Everything
it's all changed. Yep. It's all changed. And I think in general, like, but even, you know, like the wedding stuff. Like, it's like, you know, you would get a wedding into a magazine, right? Or you'd go to, like, that was how you sort of built up your reputation. And like, and it was like a hard, tangible thing that like people bought. And that whole, you know, I have friends that had to, especially it's a parallel to interior design, that had to reinvent their entire businesses, because when the model of home decor magazines sort of went away, they were like, I don't know how I get clients now. Like, it's, you know, it was really fascinating. So yeah, I thought that was also kind of why I wanted her to be of that age, because you're sort of a, you're defined by a world that's sort of slipping away and changing quickly too. And that is, and that's kind of parallel. It's like her own hometown, but also the way in which her value system is constructed and what she thinks is impressive and what she thinks will like impress other people. You know, it was a fun, it was kind
wear
of
wear this outfit, do this thing, do that.
Yeah,
thing.
Exactly.
I spent 17 years at Condé Nast. So you can just imagine, we were working at all the magazines that everybody wanted to get into.
Yes.
25 years ago. And when you realize how much it has changed, 25 years, and where it's just different. It's just the whole world has changed so much.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
Well, she also talks about the people who found out that she was left behind because she doesn't have parents. And when she exceeded, it was because she was resilient. And when she didn't do well, it was because she was parentless. And I just love those two things. And isn't it interesting that that's really the way it plays through in life? It's not because of you. It's because, oh, she had this to overcome, or she was so good because she got past this, you know?
Yeah, that definitely was something that was very, that was definitely drawn from biography. And I think especially, again, like I wanted her to be this age for a bunch of reasons. You know, they both kind of came of age in this like grittier New York. And I think there was like this weird short, nobody thinks like, oh, your parents aren't around because they're radical socialists. Like, it's like, although I said to somebody, I was like, I don't know that would have been better in South Brooklyn in the late 80s. Like, I don't know that was like exactly shined upon. My family would whisper, they're like, your mother's a socialist. Like, it was like, like, it was like totally like, don't tell anybody. But it was very much a thing where you were like, it was either a stain or an attribute, a testament. Mm-hmm. And I think this idea of not having gray area is probably a problem I'm still dealing with. I think that there are a lot of people out there that don't have these sort of neat and tidy upbringings. Mm-hmm. And this idea of how do you manage personal biography and how do you decide to be defined by it? And we see her, and you know, and that's the other thing that's so intriguing that I wanted to write about that I hadn't seen, which is not so much like her adversity as much as like what was the path that led her to actually persevere, but maybe that was at her own expense, you know? Like, it's like, and I think in that a similar section of the book, she talks about, you know, her grandmother was like, go to school and then you'll get to college. But then after that, she didn't have any map, like, right. Yeah. She's like mapless. And I do think that these things, like, it's like, well, I can be in a magazine. I can get this client. Then I get this paid more and then I can buy this bag. Like, they start to be report cards in a way. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a version of that map, you know, and somebody had asked me in a different interview, they were like, you know, came to writing later. And I was like, well, that was not like, my grandparents were like, you know, oh, you're at the library. Like, you took out this book. You could be a writer one day. Like, they were like, that's cool. Keep reading, get to college, get a job. Like, it was like, maybe you could be a teacher. Like, which I, you know, actually like teachers have shaped my whole life. But I say that to say, like, it took me a really long time to think that this was an option. And I wanted to sort of write a character that did find some success, but maybe it was not with happiness, you know, with a little lack of an internal joy, because they'd always just sort of had the choice of either letting themselves be seen as a failure or just trying to come across as a success. Like,
one or the other. Who are you going to be? This or that?
Yeah.
Or that.
Yeah,
you know what's really funny? Because I think that we charge children from the age of 5, about maybe 4, we start talking about them going to college. And it's like this end game.
Oh,
and I really find it so interesting because people say where their kid got in for freshman year. And I'll say, tell me about sophomore year. Because a lot of times they're just not in the right place. They're where that's you right. think you want to go, where you think they should be in all this.
Right.
And I do agree that like people come out of college and like, now what do I do? Like, this was since I was 3, 4, 5, I was told to go to college and to do well in college. And now I did that. And now what do I do?
Well, and one of the things,
kind of a map, you know,
and also we've become too narrow about what options we give. You know, I was very fortunate. I went to a high school that was actually founded as a trade school. So we had a very strong theater program, but mainly because it was trying to train people to get into technical theater in New York. Mm-hmm. And so to do costumes, to do lighting, to build sets, run cameras, like on a TV studio. And because of that, like a lot of my friends from high school stayed, like, you know, either maybe they went back, like a friend of mine got his engineering degree many, many, many years later, but he worked building sets for Blue Man Group for like a decade before he did that. You know, like a lot of my friends found a lot of satisfaction in that line of work. And I think that we don't encourage that enough. And I do mm-hmm. think, I also think one of the things I loved about going to Iowa was it was very different than Brown, where everybody sort of had been programmed from the earliest age at five, like, and then you'll go to Brown and then you'll go to Brown. Like if the parents brought them for their reunions, like, you know, they were literally like wearing class of 2066, like shirts from birth, you know, like, and I think at Iowa, what's been awesome there is like, you might see some people that never actually did undergrad and they like, you know, like, so there's a much more openness to you have talent, let's just get you here and do that. And I think that it attracts broader stories, which is also great, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because people are writing from a different kind of experience instead of yes. this lens of I accomplished. Yeah. I also love you talked about how exhausted the wealthy folks were planning their vacations and which home to go to and how great the divide is. And like Olga's retaliated by raising her prices because she's like, oh, they have three homes out, that price has got to go up, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I think you captured a lot about the emptiness that somebody can feel what they're doing is not fulfilling. And a lot of these people were just racing from place to place. I remember I was getting my nails done in, I guess it was like June or something like that. And this woman was trying to plan her holiday trip. Like I couldn't think about what I was doing 4th of July, let alone yep. the holiday. And she's everything going down to the islands is so expensive. The flights are $2,500. Maybe we should just go private with a couple of other families. I'm sitting there, like, this should just be my problem.
I know.
Like, I'm on what we're making for dinner tonight. Like I didn't get any further than planning for the islands yeah. in June. I'm just not there. And it, yeah. it is exhausting. And it's also, it's not just you have a jet. It's somebody's got a bigger jet. And it's yep. a whole different world that we think you just be happy with the jet, but
yep.
it's not it.
Yeah. I think that's funnily why Mabel is such an important character to me, because I wanted to show somebody that's not that motivated by those things and that is actually having a pretty great life. Like, you know, like, and it was partially why I really wanted to write the wedding because I wanted to show that like, there's also a version where you don't get on that horse. Cause like Olga's trying in her own weird way. She's charging them more, but it's also cause she sort of secretly thinks that that's like, she's cognizant that it's shallow. And at the same time, she's tormented by still wanting it. And I think Mabel's sort of like, I got this guy. Like, I just want to get a nice place in Bayshore. Like, it's like, you know, like,
and the girls are all going to wear blue.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like, it was, I wanted to sort of show a version of success with, like, this very totally good job, like, a totally nice career. She keeps getting promoted, you know, like, and there's content, there's more sense of contentment, you know, like, her biggest gripe is that her cousin used to be her closest friend and then is like, you know, disses her now all the time. So I did think I wanted to show an alternative version of not being in the quote unquote rat race, because that is what it is. It's got to be bigger and better and nicer. And yeah.
I also love that you're in the dress, but you're not over with everybody. And they're like, oh, you're wearing that color dress. You're supposed to be over there. And you're just like, oh, no. I just can't. I just really can't, you know?
I can't.
But for all the great female characters, and there are many, there are great male characters, namely Brother and Mateo. So let's talk about both of them. Let's start with yeah. the brother, because I really love the relationship she has with her brother.
Oh, I, you know, I do too. And it's funny because I don't have siblings, but I grew up with siblings, like all the time. Like, I always joke, I was like, I don't know what it was about Brooklyn, but like, you would have like Irish twins a lot of the time. So like, you know, the daughters in your class, the brothers a year older, the brothers 2 years younger, whatever it is. And so you'd be stuck, like they'd be like, okay, but you can go if you take your brother, you can go if you take your sister. And so I was always around siblings, and I just sort of love this like needing each other, but then also finding each other annoying. Like there's a scene when he's at the doctor's office with her and he's just like, and she's doing him a favor and he's so annoyed with her. Like, it's like, but I, he's like, she always gets her way. It's so annoying. Like, you know, like, and I think that this notion of at once being so like close, but also like they grating on you. Like, I love that sort of dynamic. And I loved that he's such, you know, he's in his ways, he's a really selfless person because he took on a lot of responsibility at a young age and he doesn't give himself room to have his own problems. Like he only knows how to sort of play this role of like the this patriarch that he was made to at an unusual and unappropriate age. And I think, how did that define him, right? And he's a politician and I think it's very challenging. You know, we want our politicians to be celebrities. I think especially our minority politicians, like we want them to be charming on social media. We want them to be able to do, we want them to be able to do the morning show on Hot 97, but then also be on CNN that night. And like, and so I think I wanted to sort of showcase the burden beyond just actually passing laws that like we put on our politicians. So he was a fun character to write and he's probably the most changed in revision. Like he's become more deep. And I think, you know, I think before he was kind of in the very first draft the draft that sold, he was almost more of an auxiliary character to her. And I think now he's a full presence in the book, which was really wonderful once it came time to do the show to think about his character that way. And Mateo is in some ways like the most fantastical, but also, he's like a real guy. And I just love this idea of, I don't know, this is my own judgments about middle-aged men. I think middle-aged men can, they can get very complacent. And this idea of sort of being stuck and knowing that you're stuck, I just was like, what, but you know, like, and that you find these joys in very tiny things. It's like, I'm going to go to this bar and I see this person and like habit becomes like a joy in some funny way. And I just thought that this sort of like, what if the person that actually finally stops her and gets to her is not, you know, she could be going out with this rich guy. She could be seems to be completely opposite that. And is like, you know, is like a good night out for him is like a bad bar with a jukebox. So like, you know, and I just loved that he was unglamorous and he's just been a fun character to get to know. And it's funny, like, it's not going to be my next book, but he appears in a younger version on something else that I'm working on. Like you meet like 30-year-old him, like as an auxiliary character. And he's just a character I can't get enough of, to be honest.
Yeah, I absolutely loved him because you're right. It's like, okay, yeah, this is a night out. Okay, this is fine. And she's got these high expectations. He's like, just have fun.
Let's just have fun.
Having the fun, have fun. Don't think about this.
And I think also this idea of, you know, she feels so misunderstood. I was explaining her to somebody once. It's easier for her to be by herself than to try to fit in with other people. Like she's not quite of her family. She's not quite of the social circle, the social class. And here's this guy who kind of understands, like he's been to the same type of schools. He's from the same type of part of town. And that enables her to sort of stop being so pretentious. Like, it's like, you know, like, it's like, okay, like just be real, like for 2 seconds. And what happens when you sit in that for a second? And it was fun to sort of watch somebody be the pebble in somebody else's shoe in that sense. Yeah, and the challenge of him was, how is he also not a pet pushover, you know, like, and I think like that was the chat, like, you're like, you know, he's not meant to be like a stooge. He's like, he's a dude. I kept being like, he's still a dude from Brooklyn. Like, you know, like he's going to be like, what are you talking about? Like, so I think that was the challenge.
There's still a backbone to him. There's still a backbone, but it's just like, stop, let this stuff like go up. And then there's Dick, who has, okay, now I personally, well, when she meets him, it's because they're on the private jet and he's late and she says, I'm gonna see if we can do the line. What is the point in flying private if you have to wait 2 hours? And I just loved it because he just wanders in whenever he feels like, I thought it was such a great like throwaway line of, what's the idea of flying private if you gotta sit and wait? And he has a chapter that's called, I love this, Dick's No Good, Very Bad Day. And I just love the title of the chapter. And did you always know you wanted a chapter like him in the book? Because in some ways he's like that Mr. Big, like quintessential kind of character, but you're like, who's this guy?
Yeah. You know, it's so funny because have had the fortunate privilege of meeting lots and lots and lots of different types of people. And some people describe Dick as a villain. And I actually think he's just, at the end, there's obviously like a very bad moment, but mainly I think he's just sort of self-absorbed, you know, like, and in a bit of a midlife crisis of his own. And I've just known some very good guys that have had a lot of money and privilege, and they're sort of up their own butts. And they're like, do I still have it? You know, like, and I think I sort of like this idea of this infantilized, just older guy, you know, like, it's like, he's like his first reaction is like, but this isn't what I wanted. Like, it's like, this is a little whiny. And that his harm is that he actually doesn't think about the fact that he could do harm.
Right.
And I think more often than not, people that have a bit of power, it's their lack of awareness that they're using it that makes them more dangerous, you know. And that I think was more what I wanted to look at with Dick. And you know, and I remember, because I started this, I workshopped the first half of this novel my very first week at Iowa. Like, I showed up at 200 pages. They're like, who wants to go first? You know, of course, nobody wants to go first. But I was like, well, that's kind of why I came. But that's the difference of going back to school when you're 42. I was like, well, why am I here if not to have you guys read this book? Like, so I was like, yeah, I'll hand it in tomorrow. It's fine. But, you know, I remember people being like, I don't know why Dick has a POV. But it was important to me because I think that both of these characters live where the Dicks of the world have a lot of say in their world. And mm-hmm. I think it's important to show that while they have a lot of agency, they still do live in a power structure. And like, and I wanted to sort of show that. So I always find people's perspectives on Dick so interesting. Like, it's like my weird Rorschach test of readers, like, in some ways.
Where did you see him? How does he come in? I just love the chapter name because it's, you know, like, there, go, now, Richard, out of here. Like, yes. Like, go, yes. go, you know? Speaking of chapter names, were they always there or did you add them later?
Because they were always there. I played with taking them away. Mm-hmm. And one of my classmates was like, he said, you should take away these chapter names. And then they were gone. He's like, I missed the chapter names. And so then they went back and like, and they mainly, they all came to me pretty organically. Like, there were maybe one or two that I went back and was like, I have to think about this one. And I still love them. I think that they, I don't know. They're very short. They're mainly short chapters, but I think they helped me write it in a funny way. They helped me stay focused, I think. And they were a lot of fun. They were actually a lot of fun. And obviously the letters don't have chapter titles, but yeah. But the other things, it was just sort of a good way to think about, you know, what's the point, you know?
Yeah, but it's just like the napkins. Like, it's just these very like da-da, and we're going to go there. It's like, it's almost like the car. Like, it was like, well, what's going to happen? What is going to happen? Is it going to be a good thing, a bad thing? You're not quite sure, but it gives you this little teaser. And I actually had fun going back and reading them because I had all my folded down pages in the book of what I want to talk to you about. And I kept going back and going, oh, these are so much fun because it was a clue, but it wasn't a clue. It was a clue, but oh yeah, da-da, yeah. But besides everything else, the book is an homage to Brooklyn. And what did you love about writing what you clearly are passionate about in your hometown?
Oh, oh my gosh, so much, because there's so many little Easter eggs like buried in there. Like, I wrote about Caesar's Bay Bazaar, which is like an indoor flea market, kind of like a two-story flea market that used to be like out on by the Verrazano Bridge that like hasn't existed in like 25 years. And so many people that got their hands on this book that were from Brooklyn were like, Caesar's Bay, like, you get screenshots, they text it to me. Like, so there's Easter eggs upon Easter eggs in there. But it was also, to me, I think the sprawl of Brooklyn that I think people don't get, because the gentrified version is sort of turned into like Williamsburg, maybe my old neighborhood of Fort Greene, you know, maybe Carroll Gardens. But like, there's really like, it's like so big and sprawling, and the idea that like you could move up in the world. And like, and when I was younger, you'd move to Brooklyn Heights, but she ends up moving to Fort Greene. And like, and the idea of like, okay, I'm gonna go home and it's a completely other Brooklyn, and yet it's still totally Brooklyn. And I wanted to just, and I think what I think of is like the showcasing the way that normal people live, because New York has become so glossy now, just across the board. I mean, there's so many buildings where nobody's living in them because like it's like somebody who comes for like 1 week a year, you know, like it's just so glossy. And this idea of like, okay, there's people that still buy furniture on layaway. And like, there's families that are, you know, they're buying the toys at the dollar store because the kids point to something and they pick it off. And like, and I wanted to show people the vibrancy of those neighborhoods and also the way they interrelate to each other. I always, like Brooklyn is to me, it's like a series of tiny towns connected by subway stops. And like each little area has its own vibe and that you can kind of get a taste of that too. So that was, it was so, it was fun for me. And it was also felt very urgent because it's changing so fast. Mm-hmm. That even the time from when I left to go to Iowa to when I moved back, like it was probably like right before school ended, like March 2021, this past March. And so much has changed. So many places are gone. So many, you know, new buildings are up, buildings are torn down, and the landscape is so different. And I just wanted to sort of document it as it somewhat was in that moment in time. Yeah.
Yeah, because everything just changed so much. And it's really interesting because our office was by 57th Street and all these big apartment buildings were going in and it was all foreign money that was coming in and living in these buildings. There was no, really, mostly no American money there at all. Yeah. And people have been talking to me a lot about when do you think New York comes back? And with the beginning of the pandemic, I said Q4 2023.
Yeah. And
that was really my pick way back in March 2020. And now I'm going more towards 2025, Q1 2025. And I'll tell you why, because we need the foreigners to come back. We need the money from Asia and Europe to come back and spend high end at Tiffany's. Spend high end. It's not Broadway. Broadway could be people from the Midwest. Broadway can be people from the West. That's not the same. It's to go in and really spend and stay in those hotels and whatever.
Yeah,
we need that. And the more that that keeps getting cut off, while we're disappointed that Broadway is closed, there's this whole other level of the economy in New York that needs international money. And it's all those apartments and everything that we saw or what's going on. And it's, I think the seismic shift, we're all going to remember where things were in March 2020 and now. And the shift of what's going to happen neighborhood-wise, people who left, came back, moved, whatever. It's just going to be a very different time to sit there and even just look after the past, not even, well, almost 2 years.
I know. It's wild. And I think it's also been, on my side, it's been interesting still being in touch with wedding friends to see where weddings are coming back and when they aren't. And, you know, the events, and just in general, the events industry in New York is a major part of the economy, And that, especially the benefit circuit, like, you know, actually to your point, foreign families that want to get married in New York, they want to have a New York wedding, you know, like it's a big part of the economy here. And that's been like this, you know, like, and that keeps so many people employed also, like it keeps so much money flowing in and out. So it's a wild time. It's a wild time. I didn't realize obviously that I was setting this book in an era just before times were going to really change. Do you know, also kind of funny, like now in hindsight, it'll feel like an art, like a version of life that just doesn't exist. Cause it will always be different. Right. Like,
It'll emerge. It's like people are saying right now, are you having your wedding? How many times did you cancel? Did you have to cancel three times? Did you just get married? There was a woman who works with us and we were so excited to go out to her wedding in Ohio. And it was the same weekend as Book Expo. We were trying to figure out how we would do both. And then Book Expo was canceled. And then the wedding was canceled. And then the whole thing, and it's like, so all these things you were worried about planning for ended up to not be things. They were like non-things. So
that's great. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
I was like, it's a start art. So let's go for a second though. You were raised by your grandparents and I want to take a moment to read the dedication for your book because I absolutely loved it. It's for Pop who taught me how to be proud, to all the South Brooklyn girls who stare at the water dreaming. And how did that influence, how did he influence you? How did, like, I know how they would influence you, but how about him?
My grandfather influenced me so much. Like, I mean, it's really, well, first of all, he taught me to read. He would take me to the library. That would be like where we would go after school. And then when I got a little older, that's where I was allowed to go after school. He took me to dancing school. I mean, he also made me like a perfectionist. And then, you know, when I was in high school was a really weirdly painful experience. Like I'd always done very well in school, and I got into Brown, and it was like, I absolutely found, it was like people that had been my friends were suddenly like, you only got in because you're Puerto Rican, your last name's Gonzalez, blah, blah, blah. And I remember I was like devastated by this. Like I think at that age, that also feels very painful. You don't know how to defend yourself. And my grandfather was like, well, then you go and you be as loud as you can be about who you are. And really like, and he was like you go and show them what this thing's going to do. No, really, like he was really like very like adamant about it. And I think, you know, really, and I think from that point on, like, I just decided, like, I was going to go forward and talk about my identity and my culture and my being. And and then the South Brooklyn Girls Dreaming, you know, me and my best friend who is in books, she's actually in books. It's so funny. Coincidentally, she stayed in Brooklyn. She went to Hunter and then she ended up going into book publicity. And she's one of my best friends. And we would just always go. We'd go down by Sheepshead Bay. We'd go down by the Verrazano. We would go down by the water, by the promenade in Brooklyn Heights. And you just sort of stare out and you'd see Manhattan and like, you talk about what you wanted to do and where you might want to leave and who you wish you met. And it just felt like that was always the place you went for heart to hearts. And
Yeah.
And I just, I don't know. And I remember I did that with a lot of my friends growing up. And so it just, for me, it was like, I know there's always, when you're so deep in Brooklyn, like I said, I wrote something for The Atlantic and I said, I was like, you know, there's a version of Brooklyn where somebody doesn't ever even go into Manhattan. Like it's part of the city. And they're like, the city, like I'm not going to the city. And I think this idea of it being so close, but so far, and from mm-hmm. Sunset Park, you see the skyline and it's like, you know, at once, you know, some awesome glamorous stuff is happening there. And at the same time, it feels very far, even though it's so close. So I don't know. I just, that was sort of what I was thinking about when I wrote that.
That would have been a great publicity shot of you just standing down there looking that way. You know,
Super fun. Well, it was fun when we were shooting the show. We shot so much in Sunset Park and it was really, it captured that feeling for me. So that was really cool. I loved that. I was really happy that the DP had figured that out, that shot out.
That's going to work. Well, speaking of Olga having a public meltdown, I love this. She's supposed to be doing a morning wedding segment. I can forget what it was about, but one of these morning wedding segments that look like they're very spontaneous and there's not a spontaneous second of what's going on because you're on for your 10 minutes or no, 4 minutes of whatever. So Olga's there and all of a sudden somebody says, oh, you know, you're Puerto Rican, you know, like, yeah. How is your family? And she just goes off. And they keep trying to go back to, and at the wedding, you know, and she's like, and I just feel like she was just ready to explode. I love the entire outburst because she just kept going over them and they're trying to like cut to commercial, like cut to anything. But this, was it really cathartic writing that scene of like.
It was really cathartic writing that scene. And I also, well, it's funny now we're living in this time where we're seeing behavioral outbursts all the time because I think people are like running on the edge, but she's like at a personal edge. And it's like this thing where you don't have the sense to say no. Like you're like, I can't say no. Like she knows she shouldn't probably, she's not in the space to do it. I probably shouldn't do it. I don't feel like doing it. She still says yes. And it's like the slightest thing went wrong. And it was just yes. But it was so cathartic. And it was also funny because then when it was over, you know, like the actual process of getting out of any business, any small business is actually quite complicated. Like it's like you can start to feel slightly trapped. And so it was also cathartic having had to go through contortions to extract myself from my own business to sort of give her this really awesome scorched earth opportunity to move on with her life. You know, like, and I remember she really was having a career crisis because afterwards I was like, oh my God, but what does she do for money now? Like, I didn't even know. Like
gave up her job.
Yeah, it was like, oh God. I was like, well, now she doesn't have any income. Like, you know, like, and so really it was fun and cathartic, but then it was also like it came with real world problems, like for her and me.
Yeah. It was like, okay, now what do we do next? Where do we go next with this? Where do we go? You know, I don't know. But it was just such a great scene because you could just see somebody like, I've just had it. I'm not going to take it anymore. It was sort of like, was it Andy Cohen the other night on the.
Oh yeah, totally.
I was thinking of that when I reread this morning of him just going off and off and off. And it's probably the most watched video of just talking about New York now and the mayor and blah, blah, blah.
Oh my God. No, totally. It's so true. And I think the other part about it that's so funny is also that the hosts of these things are so not equipped to deal with anything going off script. So I found that. I kind of just found that part really funny, fun and funny also. It's like, how do people react to this? Like, it's like...
One, and you're also going to be on, I've done a couple of little things on TV, and I remember I was on talking about Harry Potter one time, and they asked me, how much is the book? And I had no idea. And I knew it was the most expensive of the books, but I was like, I don't know. I really don't know. Yeah. And you're just sitting like an idiot. like you're like a complete idiot because they asked me the most basic of questions. And I've done every other thing, but I can't answer this question. I have no idea how much the book costs, you know?
I'm like so funny. And so it is so true. It's so true.
It's also like being this backstage. I would get there early and they'd be doing the news and there'd be a street, let's say in Brooklyn where there was a fire, Queens, there was a fire, right? How do you pronounce the name of the street? Is it this? Is it that? Get the police guy on the phone, get this guy on the phone. And it was just so funny to see all the details. And I'd also, about the time I read this book, I'd read Going There by Katie Couric, and you realize how scripted these things sit on the couch. I'll ask the first question. You ask the second question. Da, da, da.
Yeah.
And sometimes I watch this and I'm like, sometimes I'm doing these interviews and I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't answer the question I wanted. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't have a teleprompter telling me exactly what to say.
You know? That's right. Yes, totally. Totally. It's all very, and it's all very big business too. And I think like there's a part when she realizes, oh, they were going to let her keep going because it'll be good for clicks. Like, you know, like she realizes, oh, to a certain extent, it's just like, I'll just keep going. Like, it's like,
it's no problem. It's no problem. I'll just keep going. I'll keep going. You know? Did you travel to Puerto Rico after Irma or Maria? Like, have you been back recently? So
it's funny. I was supposed to go. Yes, I have. I was supposed to go for my 40th birthday, which is probably partially what inspired the book because my birthday fell between Irma and Maria. And then I went back to work on revisions in January of 2020. And I was there during all of the earthquakes. I was there during the beginning because those tremors went on for like, I mean, it was really crazy. And so I, you know, it's interesting because there in 2020, there was still areas in, and I mainly stayed in San Juan that trip, like that were still not, you know, back. There's definitely areas still now that don't have power. And I think that that was like definitely something that shaped what I was thinking about. And then definitely, you know, I think what was it, the summer of 2019, you know, there was so much unrest and it was kind of amazing because of the governor and these text messages, which I ended up working into like the sort of far future of the end. But yeah, it was wild. No, I mean, the hotel called me between my trip and they were like, there's no power, you shouldn't come. And I was like, okay. And that was it for Maria. And when I went back, we lost power. Well, what was bad about working on this, we lost power. And because I had done so much painstaking research, writing the hurricane scenes, I was like, well, here's how it trickles down. Like, it's like, there's no power. You can't get money from an ATM. You can't get money from an ATM. How do you get, you can't get, you know, like, and you start to like, and so it was definitely, you know, but you realize that people that have been living there that lived through Maria when that earthquake happened were like having PTSD because they lived it. I just had researched it. They had lived it. And it's like, oh my God, there's no power. Like, and so every time there's a power outage, it's like, it brings up all of these other things, especially around a natural disaster. So yeah, but I did want to go back to, I wanted to go back for sensory experience around the revisions for sure. Cause you know, I think part of the point of the book is how different the mainland experience and the island experience are.
Yeah. Yes. And I think that you did such a good job of bringing that out. You made us feel like we were there and it's so much that I didn't know. And I feel so stupid at this point that you just didn't know. It's like, yes, it's part of this country, but what you don't have, what you do have or whatever. And I think that we're so quick to cover a disaster. We're so quick to go down there. The cameras are up there. I mean, look, even the fires in Colorado last week, they're up. Yeah. that's 1,000 people that don't have a home down there. That was like, how many people without power? And you say you're not going to have power for 6 months, but does the news crew go back anytime? Maybe there's one show that goes back and does Puerto Rico now. Like, it's not, it doesn't become, and the way newspapers are structured right now is to go after whichever low-hanging fruit happened today.
Completely. So
the big story rarely gets written. The pullback, like what I said, like if you're shooting a movie, that pullback scene where you see the whole thing, we don't do that. We don't do that. We don't see what happened there, you know?
I think to me, part of the purpose of the book was to show, make you care about the characters enough that these become real experiences, because even sometimes when you get like a good human interest aspect of a story, you're with that character for maybe whatever the 1,000 words of the longer piece of newspaper piece are, you know, and it's not enough to that. You know, I think one of the few times I've seen this done, like where it's like a character, like it was that the Dasani piece in the New York Times that then became the Invisible Child book, like where people were so like, I need to know what's happening with this girl, you know, like, and I think it that was sort of what I wanted to do around the idea of colonialism, gentrification, the hurricane itself, the way that the island was treated. It was like, if I can make this family feel real enough, people will understand why these things are important. And I think, you know, and I think it's funny because it's like you growing up in Brooklyn at that, the time that I was here, like you, if you knew somebody and they were Latino, they were most likely Puerto Rican, like maybe Dominican, you know, like, but then soon, like later is Mexican American, but like now it's like, you know, we're much more, our diaspora has gotten more outspread. And so I think a lot of people don't know and aren't familiar with, as familiar with the culture, as familiar with New Rican culture, as familiar with the circumstances. And I wanted to try to avoid being polemic, but to also, talk about this thing that I think is like a really, it's a civil rights issue. It's a human rights issue that like there's a different version of citizenship, like in parts of our country. So,
and it also becomes, besides that, it also becomes, who's going to make money by going down there? Yes, oh, how can you make money? How can you capitalize? What part of capitalism could happen? Like if Apple could go down there and do more business, if they could have a factory down there and da, 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 then that becomes like why you want to be there. It's That's not right. why you want to be there to be.
Well, and it hints at a larger problem with our economy, which is like, you know, there was a boon there, and it's alluded to in the book a little bit. There was a boon there when pharmaceutical companies were incentivized to put their labs and their plants there. And then as soon as that tax incentive left, there was no stake in being part of that place and giving jobs to that community. Like it was like, okay, well, then we're going to pick up the circus and go wherever the next tax break is. And I think it implicates us in a larger way of like, why do any of us even have businesses? What is the purpose? Like it used to be, you felt proud. Like you talk to a business owner, they'd be like, I have 10 employees that work for me. And it's like he's been with me for 15 years and nobody thinks that way. It's literally like, I'm going to build this startup so I can sell it for a lot of money and somebody else can get public. Like, and I think we have lost sight of the humanity within, like, and that's not to give away the ending, but part of the purpose of Mateo was to sort of have like, you know, some kind of representative of compassionate capitalism in some way.
Yeah, grounding. There's some kind of grounding thing about the whole thing. Oh, grounding. Yeah, my son spent some time in this fall, I think it was this fall, shooting pictures, and he loves lighthouses. And he flew to Puerto Rico and drove the whole perimeter of the island shooting all the lighthouses down there. And, you know, okay, first of all, he went there because it was the United States, so you could go to someplace in the United States, let's get real, because you can't go very many places. But he also says, and he, this past week, he works with us, he is doing a work from away, and today's in El Paso, he was in Mexico a couple of days ago, and I was terrified that he was in Mexico, like you're here going to Mexico, da 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 da. And he goes, no, well, you have to understand, when you get to a place, you have a totally different feeling about it. And he says, when I was in Puerto Rico, I saw all these places. I circumvented the whole island and I saw people, you know, out working, and I saw what was going on. I didn't stay at a big resort at all. He said, I never stayed at a big place, and you have a different taste of it. He says, going into Mexico the other day, he was where a lot of Canadians winter. He said, who knew? But you never know if you didn't go do these things. And I think that that's what you're trying to share there is, you know, we've talked about, there's this place that you visit that you have an opinion of, but when you really get into what's going on there, you don't have to get political to just sit there and say, do you understand that this is what's happening
That's
here?
Right. That's exactly right. No, and that was really what I was hoping to do. So I'm glad that came across. Thank you.
Yeah, it definitely did. So was this always the title? Was this always?
Yeah, it was. It was always the title. It was only suggested to me once that I change it. It was never, and it was literally what actually what it was, would you ever be open to changing the title? And I said, no, I'm not. Like when I have a formulated opinion, but then it was never suggested. Like, so it was always the title. And yeah, it was always the title. It was like, as soon as it came to me, it came to me. And I'm pretty happy about it. And it was funny because like I had picked her name and then I found I rediscovered the poem Puerto Rican Obituary that I had known and then kind of forgotten existed. And I was like, oh, that's the perfect line for the title of this. And I do love it still.
It's like beautiful. Now tell us about the cover, because I understand you had a lot of opinions about the cover. You
mood boards. And Lauren, who did the cover, is just amazing. But I did so many mood boards about, you know, the mural culture of Puerto Rico is gigantic. And so I included some Morivivi murals. The murals are also such a, and graffiti are such a big part of Brooklyn culture and New York culture. And then I, you know, a lot of flag symbolism. So the hair, it's the hibiscus plant and it's the green of Puerto Rico and the natural flower the national flower of Puerto Rico. And then the blue is the color of the blue from the independence flag, not the American version of the flag. And then her body is the Brooklyn skyline. And originally it was at the Brooklyn Museum. And I actually had asked to put in the clock tower, which, cause I felt that's the iconic building and it's in the book. And I just think that is so, it's just such a beautiful cover. And I love, you know, it's funny. It's like, it's, you know, she's kind of every woman. She's got a face, but she's also, it could be any woman. And I love that about her.
Yeah. Because we don't, you know, a lot of times they shoot somebody from behind, but this is just, and here it's like, there's so many different parts of her. I was seeing that too, when I saw and this as well.
You know, and there's this line where it's like the one thing she's always felt was very Brooklyn. And so I love that was her body. It just really was so beautiful to me. And I, it's been such a great inspiration. And really like when we've used it as, it was so cool when we were shooting in Brooklyn, like, and it was like on all of the flyers for our locations. And so like, she's become our icon. She's our beacon. I know, I love it.
We've talked a lot about shooting and we talked a lot about that there's a show. So tell us, okay, there's a show coming on Hulu, if I'm correct? Well,
we shot a pilot, so we're waiting to get to see if we get a series order, and I'm hoping for the best, but it is pretty fantastic. Hulu's been very supportive. We did like a 2-week shoot, and then obviously there's prep and post, and so it takes a really long time, but we were shooting for 2 weeks in Brooklyn, and Aubrey Plaza is playing Olga, and Ramon Rodriguez is playing her brother, Prieto. Jesse Williams plays Mateo, and it's actually his first, neither of them has done a ton of TV lately, but he hasn't done anything since Grey's, so it's kind of exciting. We lured him back to television, and then Jessica Bimental plays Mabel and Wanda de Jesus plays Blanca. And it's just been a tremendous, and there's so many other wonderful, wonderful actors, like just fantastic. And it was very cool. I worked with Alfonso Gomez Arajon who's my co-executive producer on developing it. And I worked on the script, and it was a really cool process to sort of do this thing that had been private and in the context of these covers, and then kind of see how it's collaborative, you know, like, and what are the things that the actors bring to life, and what are things that, like, you know, like some things just change, like have to change a little bit. And then the other thing that was so cool was some characters that just get a tiny bit of airspace. If you're going to show them in life, you kind of need to see them. So like we meet Sarita, who is like Prieto's ex-wife, like we meet Julio, who's Mabel's fiance, you know, like, and you're seeing these other characters that you don't actually get to hear from that much in the book. And that was a lot of fun. And you're meeting so many mothers of the bride, which is also a lot of fun.
I could just picture this part. So here's a question for you. Did you write the screenplay? Like, okay, so where were, okay, so the parts of this was, did you sell the book first and then sell the screenplay? Or
I did, yes. I sold the book first, and then my agent, Molly Glick at CAA, just always from the first 100 pages was like, we're going to sign with us for book and book to film. So she always had sort of had a thought that we would do this quickly. And I think, you know, there's, I just knew I needed to do it because it's so hyper-specific to a very, the world is very specific. This community is very specific. South Brooklyn to me is very specific. I've lived all over Brooklyn. It's very specific. And I just felt like I was like, if you can get me names of other screenwriters from this sort of background of my age range, like, you know, like I'm happy to talk to people. And, you know, soon they were like, you should just do it. And what was great was that that's what Hulu had wanted. You know, they felt like this is a universe that has been in some ways, like we talk about it, people talk about it like it's sci-fi and I'm like, it's just South Brooklyn. They're like, it's such a specific universe. And I'm like, it's just South Brooklyn, but it is, you know, it's like I had a reader that had had at ARC sent me the sweetest note. She was like, I'm Polish from Queens. And I just love that you got the Polish community so right. Like it was like, and I was like, oh, thank you. I was like, but you know, I think South Brooklyn is this place that sort of is very like ethnically immigrant and it mixes a lot of different weird cultures, not weird cultures, but cultures weirdly, I should say, like the way in which like, you're like, let's go get pierogies. Like, you know, like it's like this way. I think that was something, a flavor that I knew I wanted to keep there. And so it's been a great experience and it's been fun. Our prop master, a lot of people live in Brooklyn, but our prop master lives in Brooklyn and she was just having the best time with it. Like she was having like the best time with like decorating, like what's in the front yard of the house. Like, you know, like it was just so, it was really a great thing. Like, and we do the letters sometimes you get in flashback and like just doing 90s Brooklyn was so, with costuming was so fun. And like, it was a great, awesome experience really.
So what was it like writing a screenplay? Had you ever written one before? Like had you written one even? Write a screenplay.
I had to learn how to use the software. I downloaded a lot of free pilots from shows that I was familiar with. And then I would read them. And then this is actually during the beginning of the lockdown. So it was a good opportunity to do it. And I would read them and then I would read them and I'd watch the episode to understand how they would do descriptions of strange things. And like, and then one of the main critical things that Alfonso and I decided right away was like, at that moment, I think Fleabag was very popular and it was like, we're not going to have her talk directly to camera. So from the writing side, you realized, okay, so you're not going to hear what we would call in literature, like interiority. Yeah. Like, so I would describe, well, she opens up the closet and this is, you see, it's a closet full of dresses, all exactly the same, but different colors. Like it's like, and how do you show who, like the dishes are perfectly organized. And then there's like one brown university mug, like, you know, like, and just like, what are these things that tell you about who she is? And then Aubrey is actually like, I say actually, just because a lot of people haven't seen some of her films and her film work is so unbelievable. She's an unbelievable actress and she just kills it. And her Brooklyn accent is on point and it's great. Yeah, it's really great.
You know, it is so funny because it is what you can actually show, not tell. Whereas on the page, you've got to keep the story moving. Here, yeah. You could just put it up on the thing and just keep going. And there's a lot that just can come off the page because you can just show what's going on. You don't need to write it into the script.
That's very right. Interesting. Yeah, at the same time, you have to write enough for the characters, the actors to get stuff together. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, like, you know, when Jesse came and it was like, it's like he pulls out his thick quarter wallet. And it was like, you know, we had so much fun with it. It was like, how do you want this thick quarter wallet to be? It was really, really great. Like that kind of thing. And just terrific. And you do get to see Dick take his dick pics. Laz Alonso plays Reggie. He's fantastic. Like, oh my gosh. Yeah. It was really, really cool.
So what did you shoot, a pilot or a couple, or what did you do?
Shot a pilot. And now we're waiting to get hopefully a season order. And the first season would cover the bulk of the book, except for the time jump at the end. We'd be shooting, if we get the order, we'll be shooting this late spring and summer.
Yeah. When do the orders usually come? Is it like May? Is May usually
time? No, we'll find out right away.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we'll find out soon, very soon. I'm like, I might end this Zoom and check my email and need to get on a call. No,
it's there we go. There we go.
It's happening really, really fast. So,
but it's so interesting that it's happening the same time as the book, because a lot of times it's not. It's a couple of years later. Yeah. It's a little bit further down the pike, you know?
It was wild. You know, Emily Upton Davis at Hulu, she texted me yesterday because it was pub day to congratulate me. And I was, you should congratulate yourself. You pulled this off the pile. Like, you know, like it was really, I was surprised. And I think it never usually comes together this fast. And Alfonso and I had a great, amazing relationship that to pull it, like we really were on the same page and shared a vision from the very beginning. And mm-hmm. I think Hulu loved all the things that we loved about the book. And so it worked out. It never felt like things were against us. I think, you know, probably what would happen is like the book would be out for a while by the time the actual series is done and, mm-hmm. you know, color corrected and ready and edited and, you know, scored and all this stuff. So, you know, it'll end up having its own, what's beautiful, because I always wanted it to be this way. The book will have its own life, but these books were going around like Bibles on that set. Like, you know, like every actor was like, you know, pouring over it.
The characters are fully developed.
Yeah, exactly. It's partially why when it was like we were going to do a virtual event for the book, I was like, we should do it with Jessica. I was like, Jessica's read this book so many times, like Bumenthal, who plays Mabel. And it was like, you know, I was like, Jessica has the best questions about the book, so we should just talk to her. Like, and it was really a really cool thing to also, I don't think anybody's, when we've changed the book to make the show, it's because the change actually helps it stay truer than doing it, you know, like, so I think so, like in the show, for instance, she auditions in the pilot to try to get the morning show gig, you know, like, so you get to see her audition and that's kind of, it was kind of fun, but I think it was better to see it than to have it be in flashback. And I, you know, yeah. So when there's adjustments, the adjustments are in service of keeping the book intact, actually, I think.
I'm impressed, because usually when a place, first of all, people can't adapt their own material at all. They like, they're in over their head, either that, or they're so married to the way it is on the page that they can't see any change happening to it. And you sort of have to sit there and go, yeah, do this, make it better, twist it here. It's hard to go to film. And I don't think people realize how hard it is to take something and move it, because it's not quite the same thing.
Yeah. You know? I think it requires a mental shift where you appreciate. I was very blessed. Everybody at Flatiron loved this book, helped get it into its best possible shape. So I felt very confident, and I believe in this book so much. I'm very proud of it. And so it was okay to play. Like then it was like, well, now we're doing something different. We're doing a different thing. And like, cause I felt very good about this way. And you know, and I think I've been shocked already at just how the story has been touching readers, because, you know, we had this chance with Book of the Month for people to get it a little bit early. And when it hits, it really hits. So, you know, I'm sure some people will be like, that wasn't how I was picturing this. Like, that isn't how, you know, like it's inevitable. But I think most people will find it's so New York. The show is so New York. It's delicious. Oh my God. Errol Lewis.
That's what people love. They love that kind of a thing. You know? So wait, do you have your chair from, like, you know, your executive director chair?
You know what? I need to get it from props. I need to get it from props, because it's going to go in my backyard in the summer, but hopefully I have a new one. I have a new, nice, even fancier one, because we'll be shooting a whole season.
Exactly. Their name, like, you know, Boston. Yes. Da, 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 da. What about the audio? Did you pick the people who were the narrators on this?
I did. Yeah. I you may have heard rumor. It was very heavy handed in this process, but it was great. I was very protective, I guess, but always, you know, listened to, and it was very collaborative, and it was great. Honestly, a couple of people came on my radar because they had read for parts in the pilot. And then a couple of people, you know, are very like, do quite a number of audiobooks. And it was really, I just love the way that the audio is coming together, and they did a beautiful, beautiful job. And you know, it was important that the pronunciation be right. I think, like, even when I was writing, I've spent, you know, a lot of time in Mexico. My best friend is Mexican. I'm part Mexican. I spent a lot of time around Dominicans. I like wanted to make sure that my Spanish wasn't polluted with other slang, you know, like other cultural slang. So it was very important that we have actual, like, you know, Spanish-speaking Puerto Ricans like reading, because when you do the Spanish, let it be right. So probably way better than even my own bad Spanish is. But like, you know, it was really important to me, and I think it ended up having so much flavor and I don't know. I people are really loving the audiobook, which makes me really happy too. Cause it's, you know, it's long. It's not the shortest audiobook.
No, it's not a short book. No, it's not. And I will say though, I go back to, I thought it was a very different book when I was like, well, rom-com-y feeling at the beginning. And then you realize, wait a second, this book is going to shift. And this book is going in a different direction, but still she's the same character and I'm loving her. But it was very, very interesting to see how you did that and pulled it off so well. So what's next? Did you have something next?
Yeah, I'm working on a book that is like, it's a cross between, it takes place in two worlds. It's partially a campus novel that takes place in the 90s. And it's partially a New York art world novel. So in both things, there's like an aspiring artist and then an actual, like it's sort of about women and legacy and love and who becomes icons and who gets erased from history and how do we keep in touch with that. And it's loosely inspired by Ana Mendieta and Carl Andre. She was a Cuban performance and artist and sculptor, and he was a sculptor, and she he may or may not have pushed her out of a window. And so it's kind of, my background was art history in college. And in some ways, this is like giving me a really good playground to go back to a lot of that. So I'm excited. I've been spending, I quarantined before this book launch so that I wouldn't have COVID on my pub day. And I ended up doing so much great writing. And when things calm down a little bit, I'm going away for a bit just to keep going on this. And I'm never happier than when I am working on prose fiction. Like, and I actually love screenwriting, but it feels more like a puzzle. Like, you know, prose fiction, it's like really relaxing to me. And they're great characters. They're good characters in this new book. So I'm excited.
Can you write like for hours or do you...
Yes.
You can just
my gosh, yes, like especially once I'm really in it, like I'm in the early stages. I have a full outline of this book, but like I'm in the early stages of putting the meat on the bone. And but when I'm really in it, like, oh my god, when I was in Iowa, that was like halfway through, like 200 pages in, I would just do 10 or 11 hour days, like, and yeah, like, and I mean, and I'd be annoyed that I'd have to stop for something, you know, like I'm like, oh, class. Like, you know, like I missed so many classes because I was like, I'm writing, like, I don't know, I'm writing and I have to keep doing it. So, yeah, like when I really get going, when you're first learning who the characters are, sometimes it's harder to sit for the hours, but mainly it's beautiful for me. It's very meditative. It's really meditative. I was, you know, like a lot of writers, I guess I was kind of enjoying the pandemic because I didn't have to make up excuses to not see people to a certain extent.
Yeah, that's right. So you don't have to get together. I can just go do this instead.
Yeah,
you
know? Exactly.
It's funny because they have things like, you know, the author lunches and this, and I'm just sitting there like, I have to spend 3 hours doing something, but I now watch somebody for half hour online. It's okay. Like,
yeah,
I used to think the food was like the most important thing. Like, oh, let's go get the food and hang out with everybody. Give me the meat on the bone. So let me watch the author.
It's going to come back or not. You know, that's so interesting.
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that you can reach people across the country now.
Yes.
Like with our readers, if I do something, it's people across the country. It's not who can just come see me in New York or come
I know,
see like, whatever.
So true. Well, it's so true. Even with this event that we're doing with Jessica tomorrow, so many of my classmates from Iowa are coming because it's like their way of coming to like a book thing for me since I can't physically do them. So that was also very cool. Yeah.
There are readers, you know, we've been around, we started on America Online. So we've been in every small town in America, as I say,
everybody's
there to check out and stuff like that. We've been around for 25 years. And it's very interesting because mostly people have never seen a live author event. There's never, so now all of a sudden us being able to do Book Reporter talks to and get people to be able to see authors like this, it's been a huge gift. And it was something that before people weren't going to do because it was just, well, we're going to go live and see everybody. And now there are a lot of authors that said, I didn't miss a flight last year. I didn't have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go anyplace.
Yeah.
This was just fine, you know?
So interesting. So, we'll see. Oh my gosh, this is lovely.
But no, this has been such a pleasure. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to, first of all, seeing what readers feel about this book, like our readers and what the feedback is. And also looking forward to seeing what you do next because
I've
been intrigued.
Oh, thank you so much. And this is really a lovely conversation. So have a great day. And I just appreciate your enthusiasm for Olga.
And to our readers, look forward to seeing you next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Olga Dies Dreaming by Soshil Gonzalez, narrated and read by Inez del Castillo, Maria de Guerra, and Armando Riesco, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Macmillan Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. And now, hear an audio excerpt from Olga Dies Dreaming, narrated by Inez del Castillo, Almario Guerra, and Armando Riesca, courtesy of Macmillan Audio.
The telltale sign that you are at the wedding of a rich person is the napkins. At the not rich person's wedding, should a waiter spill water or wine or a mixed drink of well liquor onto the napkin-covered lap of a guest, the beverage would beat up and roll off the cheap square of commercially laundered polyblend fabric down the guest's legs, eventually pooling on the hideous, overly busy patterned carpet designed and chosen specifically to mask these such stains. At the rich person's wedding, however, the napkins are made of a European linen fine enough for a Tom Wolfe suit, hand-pressed into smooth order and trimmed with a gracious hemstitch border. Should the waiter spill any of the luxury bottled water, vintage wine, or custom-crafted cocktails designed by a mixologist for the occasion, the napkin would, dutifully, absorb any moisture before the incident could irritate a couture-clad guest. Of course, at the rich person's wedding, the waitstaff don't spill things. They have been separated and elevated from their more slovenly, less coordinated brethren in a natural selection process of the service industry that judges on appearance, gait, and inherent knowledge of which side to serve from and which to clear. The rich person's wedding also never features hideous carpet. Not because the venue or locale might not have had one, but because they had the money to cover it over. And not necessarily just with another nicer, more tasteful carpet, but with hardwood flooring, black and white Havana-inspired tiles, or even actual natural grass. These, though, were the more obvious markers of wealth at a milestone life celebration for the rich person. And while Olga Isabel Acevedo's job required her to worry about all of these elements and more, the present moment found her primarily concerned with the napkins. Mainly, how she could steal them when the party was over. Carlos, she called out to the authoritative-looking waiter who was leading the caterer's setup team. Carlos, let's talk about the napkins. He eagerly made his way over, followed by three of his other black-clad compatriots. The rich person's wedding not only had better napkins, it had elaborate plans for them as well. They were manipulated into intricately folded shapes and wrapped around lavishly printed menus or adorned with anything ranging from single-stemmed flowers to braided ribbon to, on one occasion, of which Olga was particularly proud, a leather band burnished by a miniature branding iron. The groom, a fourth-generation cattle rancher. Olga demonstrated a complex pleating pattern, which was then placed on a diagonal across the display plate, with a place card then set atop that. Now, Carlos, it's critical that the napkins be placed at exactly 30-degree angles from what would be 12 o'clock on the plate, and even more critical that the place card be set parallel and not perpendicular to that angle. The mother of the bride said she might do some spot checking with her protractor, and after a year of working with this woman, I'd say odds are high that she actually does it. Carlos nodded with understanding, almost as if he knew that the mother of the bride had an advanced degree in geometry that had been gathering dust for the past 30 years while she reared her brood and supported the career of her automobile CEO husband, and that she had chosen to channel her intellectual frustrations into the anal-retentive micromanagement of her eldest daughter's wedding. Of course, Carlos knew none of this, but having been in the business for decades, he didn't need the specifics to understand the importance of executing the task at hand with precision. The wedding of a rich person also had, at least for the workers involved, the looming possibility of litigation hovering in the near future. Not rich people's events had forgettable glitches. Gaffes to the ultra-wealthy were unforgivable grievances that only the courts could remedy. A recent tale of a florist in fiscal ruin because she substituted an Ecuadorian rose for an English one after her shipment was stuck in customs had struck a nerve. Everyone, from the delivery guy to the wedding officiant, was on their toes. Now listen, Olga continued. These were custom-made just for the wedding, and the bride wants to have them for her house. What's she gonna do with 300 napkins? One of the waiters interjected. He was clearly new. 600, actually, Olga offered. Always good to have extras, right? The staff laughed. She claims they'll be heirlooms. Point is, we need to be sure that we keep these separate from the rented linens at the end of the night. Got it? The waiters collectively nodded, and like a colony of ants given orders from their queen, ran off to execute the said napkin plan. Olga did some mental math. It would take 6 pairs of hands another 4 hours to create an optic that the guests would undo in seconds with the flick of a wrist. 290 guests, to be exact.
Thank you for listening to this clip, provided to you by Macmillan Audio. To hear more, look for this title wherever audiobooks are sold.